happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage, Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time, Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough, and last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and thank you so much for tuning in. These are crazy times. I don't think any of us really know what to expect around the corner. We're all hunkered down, washing hands like crazy. Coronavirus is all on our minds. And I just want to give a reminder out there that there are so many amazing musicians out there right now who are out of work. So many amazing luthiers who can't show their guitars at shows, who desperately would love to sell you one of their guitars. To just keep your eyes open. There's a lot of amazing, cool stuff out there that you should check out, if for no other reason than to kill time. And on that note, I decided to start an informal virtual little guitar festival that we are calling FJ Fest, hashtag FJ Fest. This is a place where on our website and our social media channels, we're going to be sharing some of the cool instruments that our friends have available. We're also going to be sharing some instructors who would love to give you an amazing Skype instruction lesson right now, and a lot more. If any luthiers are out there listening to this, grab your iPhone, put it on video mode, give us a little shop tour of the stuff you're working on. Take a little video, send it to me at festival@fretboardjournal.com. We will share it. If anybody out there has any live streaming concerts with a tip jar or anything, hashtag it, FJ Fest. We'll try to share it if we can. This is going to require a collective effort to get our little community's economy back on track. I know there's a lot to be determined. I know the world feels like it's falling apart, but I know we also will support each other. On that note, I don't want any advertising money from any of these luthiers who are desperate to sell a guitar, or any of you musicians out there who had to cancel a tour. But I will say, if anybody wants to support what we are all about, get a digital subscription to the Fretboard Journal magazine. It's $30, and you'll not only get the next four issues we put out, but the last two. And I can tell you right now, those last two issues had some incredible content, probably around 300 pages of meaty editorial that you can dive into right now while you're sitting at home. And you can look at them on your laptop or your iPhone or your iPad or whatever you have. And you'll be supporting what we are about, because all the stores, all the guitar stores are, I think, temporarily closed. All of the festivals have been postponed. All the things where people would normally see a magazine like ours, I think, are going to be affected in a big way. And we are here in Seattle, where I feel like we're a few days ahead of the curve. So I hope you will support us, and also look for that hashtag FJ Fest. It starts on Friday. We have a concert with Al Pettaway, thanks to Dream Guitars. We'll be sharing, and a lot more. Friday, again, March 20th, is when all the fun happens. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Peter Henriksen, another guy who's got a guitar festival, the Rocky Mountain Archtop Festival. But most importantly, he's the guy behind Henriksen Amplifiers, the amazing line of amplifiers that until recently were mainly for, I think, jazz guitar players, but now have really branched out. So all sorts of players, acoustic and electric, open micers, and people in bands have been turning to Henriksen amps. He is up to a lot of cool stuff. So I hope you enjoy this talk. We have, of course, a couple of other podcasts you should check out. Luthier on Luthier. We also have a new Truth About Vintage Amps podcast posting this week. And if you are thoroughly not sick of my voice, I had an epic conversation with my friend Mike Squires on his Couch Riffs podcast. So check that out. In other news, like I said, support us if you can. Get a digital subscription to the Fretboard Journal. Issue 46 is just around the corner. Our electric annual, despite some hiccups and now some slowdowns because of staffing at our printer, will be coming out in about 10 days. So everybody who pre-ordered that, Thank you. You'll be getting that, I promise you. And then, of course, if you haven't ordered that, you can on our website. That's separate from a regular subscription, just because we know a lot of our readers do not want an electric guitar magazine. They want the Fretboard Journal that they've known and loved since David Grisman and Tony Rice were on the cover. So it's an add-on for those of you who want to get adventurous and take a journey with us down that little rabbit hole. You can find all that via the show notes. All right, here is my talk with Henriksen. I hope you enjoy it. Peter, thanks for talking to me. I see you at all the guitar shows now, and I'm seeing you more and more online. But for folks maybe who don't know about Henriksen Amps, give us a brief history.
Sure, no problem, Jason. Thanks for having me on. Brief history of Henriksen amplifiers. It all started with my dad. He kind of it got retired as he could get and decided to start playing guitar a little bit more and couldn't find an amplifier that he liked. So he built one, had enough people ask him about, you know, the prototype and thought it sounded really good that he decided to build 10 of them, sent those around, and enough people liked that he called me and asked if I wanted to go into business with him building guitar amplifiers. And that was 2006. We shipped our first one.
Wow. And what was that first amp like?
It was, as far as I know, it's still out there. So we still are in contact with our very first customer. So it was a single channel, single 10 inch combo. We just called the Jazz Amp. That's all we did. Sure. It didn't have a model number or anything. And no reverb. It was just volume and a 5-band EQ. I think that was the feature set.
Now, your dad obviously had some sort of electronics or engineering background to just whip that out. It wasn't like a Fender clone.
No. He, during the late 70s, all the way up through the early 90s, he owned a company of Henriksen Data Systems, and they manufactured everything, you know, starting out with, I think, telex connectors to some telephony equipment up to like PBX phone switching systems. So he had quite a background in running electronics manufacturing. And in fact, when we got back into doing the guitar amplifiers, a lot of our old accounts were still open, like our Mauser account and DigiKey from way, way back.
Nice. What did you already have an electronics background too when you joined him?
Well, I grew up, that was my summer job. Instead of mowing lawns, I was stripping wires and soldering circuit boards, and knew my way around a test bench. My background I was doing software at the time. So I knew just enough about electronics to be a little bit dangerous, but that was much more my dad's background.
Got it. Now you guys obviously have a varied roster of amplifiers, but I'm curious, give folks out there, you know, we do this Vintage Amps podcast I co-host, and we tend to talk, you know, in the Fretboard Journal more about that stuff. But what makes a great jazz guitar amplifier in your mind?
It's mostly about being a full spectrum kind of response to the guitar. I think with jazz guitar, you definitely want a more piano like response, whereas the scooped kind of approach to a rock and roll amp is more appropriate to get rid of some muddiness for that style of playing. So I think that's kind of where the differences start, is that you want high clean headroom and good mid-range response for jazz and acoustic, versus a little more breakup headroom and a scoop response for more mainstream styles of guitar.
And obviously overdrive, you don't want overdrive, but I'm curious, acoustic arch, sometimes you do.
Yeah. Everything's kind of a crossover these days. There's not a lot of people doing well, there's plenty of people doing it, but crossover approaches to tones and styles are more mainstream than, you know, mainstream itself.
Sure. And in your estimation, you don't want to work with tubes for what you're doing, or is that more of a weight factor?
A lot of it's the weight factor, but it's also, for jazz guitar, the difficulty with tube amps is the sweet spot. And, you know, being able to play them clean, you know, an all tube amplifier with enough headroom to play clean at loud volumes is a little inconvenient to drag to, you know, a jazz trio gig up three flights of stairs in a wine bar. So I think, you know, that's probably the primary issue.
Yeah. And when you say, you know, trying to bring out the sound of a acoustic, or not an acoustic, but of an archtop guitar, when you play an archtop acoustically, a lot of them, you know, there's not a lot of sound there. I'm just curious, do you want Henriksen amps to be completely neutral, or is there like a tone range you're going for? Do you want to color anything at all?
Well, every amplifier by its nature is going to have some coloration, but our approach has always been to interfere with the signal as little as possible, mm-hmm. and just let the natural sound of the pickup, as the pickup designer intended, in conjunction with how the guitar vibrates and the strings interplay with that, and just make the truest sound out of the guitar, as, you know, as loud as the person wants to hear it.
Sure.
Our amplifiers, you know, along that line, our amplifiers don't have traditional tone controls. They just have an equalizer.
So you can kind of dial in and eliminate the pick noise if you need to, or whatever.
Yeah, it's much more about adjusting the amplifier to the room.
Yeah.
So if you're getting, you know, some boomy reflections, or conversely, if something's eating a certain signal frequency range, you can boost that. But the tone coming from the guitar and from your hands is just what we make louder.
Yeah.
You know, we want to make our amplifier as, you know, as transparent as possible, but without that, you know, hi-fi sterility that you get with some solid state amplifiers.
Now, as with tube amps, are there some guitars that play better than others with your amps, or it's not really a factor?
Did you say some guitars?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on who you ask and who's listening, but, you know, for our amplifiers, humbuckers are easy plug and play. They all sound the way, like I said, like the pickup designer intended them to sound. There isn't any real pickup that doesn't really work with our amps, with the exception of, say, like older style floating pickups. Those are just difficult to amplify regardless, but I think that's true across, you know, all manufacturers of amplifiers. The older floating pickups are problematic.
Sure.
You know, much like with acoustic stuff, the older school transducers are difficult to amplify as well. New stuff is, it's made so well. There's been a lot of advancements. Pretty much everything sounds good.
Sure. Were you a jazz player before you took this gig on?
No.
Are you now?
No. I try. I'm many, many years of hours a day of practice away from being a real guitar player, certainly for jazz. But I grew up playing music and appreciating it for sure. Jazz guitar was my dad's passion that I sort of inherited along with the company. And as an appreciator of the music, it's been wonderful. But also, you know, I feel like I get to meet the best people in this genre. it takes a lifetime to master. People are still learning lessons in their 70s enthusiastically. It's not something you can pick up and be great at a few years. It's a lifetime pursuit, and I like being around people who understand that and who dedicate their lives to it.
Yeah. Now you've obviously, with some of your amps like the Blue, you've addressed the weight and size factor, and you've got Bluetooth now and some amps. What are some of the requests that you continuously get that you may or may not ever address from jazz players in terms of what they want?
I think we've got the jazz player pretty well accommodated. The only thing that we get requests for, as a practical matter, that I don't think we'll be doing anytime soon, is a battery powered amp, for a lot of reasons. But number one, there's a big regulatory headache with manufacturing things with big batteries in them. I'd much rather just recommend, there are some inverter battery pack type of solutions out there in the photography world that if you ground them right, you can get a 5-6 hour gig out of one of our amplifiers.
Yeah. Cool. And I'm curious with, I'm looking over your lineup. There's some pretty small speakers in some of your amps. The Blue's got like a 6.5-inch speaker. Are there trade-offs there, or are speakers so good now that you can get that full range jazz sound with tiny speakers?
There have been some serious advancements in speaker manufacturing, just maybe in terms of the quality. I don't think you can get as much sound out of a small box as we'd get without the specific speakers that are in there, and they weren't, they haven't been made the way they've been made for that long. Fundamentally, a speaker hasn't changed very much, but I think it's the quality of manufacture and the advancements in that are really pushing the limits, and the demand for line array systems making things smaller and smaller.
Got it. Are you working with those speaker manufacturers directly and kind of giving them feedback?
We've always stocked Imminent speakers in our amplifiers, sometimes off the shelf, but a lot of OEM stuff, because they, they make the best speakers for what we do.
Yeah. And now, obviously, I've been mentioned the word jazz 1,000 times, but you've got guys using the Bud and a bunch of these for just open mics or any acoustic guitar, right?
Yeah, well, the Bud really changed everything for us. The name, Bud, was my dad's name. And so that's it kind of came about because of the way the amplifier came about. I was clearing out a box of his stuff after moving it a few times, and there was a tiny box with the 6-inch speaker in it, and it happened to be the same size as one of the power boards for the new heads that we were putting out. And I had a slow day, so I thought, well, let's see how small of an amplifier we can build out of this. And put it on my desk, took a picture of it, put it on Facebook, and the response was pretty big, like, hey, I'd like to try that. And so I wanted to build just a small jazz amp. And we had my friend Sean McGowan come over, and I told him, I'm like, listen, thinking about putting this into production, but I don't want to do this unless it's really giggable. Like, you can be a professional and buy this from me and do gigs with it. So he said, okay. Brought every single guitar he owned, which was like a lot. Sean had a lot of guitars. And the last one we went through was his flat top with a K&K in it. And it sounded so good. We couldn't believe how great the acoustic guitar sounded and how much sound was coming out of it. We were shocked. And so, talked it over with, Nate, our vice president and engineer. And he said, basically, well, there's, good news and bad news. The good news is, yeah, this is going to be a great acoustic guitar amp. But the bad news is now we need phantom powered inputs and two channels and input gains and all of this other stuff. And it sort of, it just started to snowball from there. And by the time we put it out, it really is, I don't say this as a sales pitch. You really can throw anything at these and they sound great. So because they're 120 watts, even though they're so small, you can do the singer-songwriter thing with them and not have to drag a PA with you. And that's been a lifesaver for a lot of people. Or duet gigs, you know, or trading off between, you know, you got a Telecaster in one channel and an acoustic guitar in the other channel. And it's not really aimed at a specific genre or style like the jazz amp was. It really is, a useful Swiss Army knife.
Yeah. What is the R? You kind of mentioned it, but what's the R&D process for something like that? You find the speaker and your dad's belongings. How many iterations before the finished product? I know you said you wanted, Phantom Power was needed and a bunch of other doodads, but is it all on you? Are you there with like a soldering iron making this all happen?
I was. And right before the Bud sort of came about is when I hired Nate Mender just to work one day a week to help me do some repairs. And he's turned himself into quite the engineer and is responsible for, taking all these ideas and turning them into a reality.
Got it. How big of a company is it right now? How many employees do you have?
There's 5 of us.
Okay. It's amazing.
In 5 short years, Facebook keeps showing me those, those Facebook memories and the summer NAMM show of 2015 was our first real, it was my first time exhibiting at a NAMM show since 2010, because when my dad died and the economy collapsed, I just kind of, quit going to the NAMM show. Mm-hmm. With the Bud, we thought, okay, well, there's a reason for us to be back out there, and there's a reason for us to reach out and, find more people than just the straight-ahead jazz guitarist, because this thing works so well for everything. And so we've committed ourselves to that and doing a bunch of guitar shows and, advertising more and just talking to more people. And it just turns out, our product line is really geared towards everybody. It is what it is. It's not an old tube amp. There are plenty of those, but it does take pedals extremely well. And it's a great recording interface for, if you use the line out, it's really clean. We get a lot of people that send us albums they used it for.
Yeah.
And, got the headphone here we
jack.
Are.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's yeah. Totally. The world of jazz, amplifiers has been such an odd limiting one. There were polytones back in the day and all that stuff, but you guys have captured a piece of the market that was really not being addressed very well.
Well, I think with the demise of polytone over the course of time, by the time my dad started picking up the guitar again and looking for an amplifier, he tried to buy a few of them, but the company was in such bad shape. They weren't putting out very good product and it was impossible to find one. And that was 2005, but they certainly, as a company, they certainly paved the way for small, portable, solid state, sounds good with the jazz guitar kind of thing. But what we've found is by putting out something that's that, neutral, I don't want to imply bland, but that neutral and accepting of whatever input you put in it, that's great. And it's ideal for jazz guitar, but it also makes it great for so many other things. Totally. Jazz guitar has always been just plug and play, traditional straight ahead stuff, but, the ability to be very articulate, there's very little compression on these amplifiers. Unlike with tube amps, you get compression, a good sounding compression, but it's still some compression. And the dynamics you can create with one of our amplifiers is just goes from, the sound of breathing to, back in your chair loud.
Neat. What would be if, we've talked about portability and small speakers and some of the things that a gigging musician who's traveling and playing cafes or wherever might need. But for those guys out there, and I know they're listening to this podcast, they've got a Ken Parker or a Mona Leone or a Benedetto that never leaves the house. Like, what is the ultimate jazz amplifier, like size no object, weight no object? It's not going anywhere. What would you gravitate towards?
Man, that's a really tough thing, because I have heard some really incredible sound systems that the key is weight and a lot of it, so that mm-hmm. you perfectly baffle the speaker. And, you know, I think ideally the perfect speaker cabinet is like 10,000 pounds made of steel.
Okay.
That's what Hi-Fi audio people tell me. I think ideally you'd want 5 or 6 different amplifiers to plug. Every guitar sounds different and has quality attributes, and I don't think there is an ideal with amplifiers. Yeah. And for some people, they want a larger speaker. For hollow body guitars, that can be a feedback issue. One of the nice things about our smaller speaker units is it's sort of naturally feedback resistant, if that makes sense.
Sure. What's your test guitar?
Our test guitar is an Eastman. I don't remember the model number, with apologies to Eastman.
Okay.
It used to be an Eastman El Rey, designed by our friend Otto D'Ambrosio. And it was a guitar that I traded an amplifier for, because mine were kind of getting too sentimental value to leave as shop guitars. And so on this forum, a guy had one for sale, and I just emailed him like, hey, would you trade an amp for that? Because I need a good shop guitar. And it was perfect. Except it was a shop guitar, and so over the years it had fallen over a few times and taken quite a bit of abuse. And a friend of mine who works for Eastman was at the shop, and he saw the atrocity that guitar had become. So many a luthier has attempted to bring it back to life, but he said we'll get this taken care of for you. So they've loaned us a guitar that it's their 2-pickup L5 size cutaway guitar, and I apologize, I can't remember the model number, but it's it as advertised, it's been indestructible. It lives in a warehouse with two natural gas space heaters in it. It's in Colorado. The humidity gets down to 12%, and the thing's great. No cracks. No, yeah, it's been great. Very indestructible. So that's the shop guitar.
Yeah. 12% humidity. Are you having to worry about wood issues the way a luthier would for the cabinets?
No, okay. Because they are not really, they stay in their packaging until we stuff them and put them back in the packaging. So we don't run our own cabinet shop. Like most amp companies don't, because it's a huge investment in equipment and time and labor. And so when we get the cabinets from the manufacturer, they come in, retail ready packaging for us. So when we pull them out, they've been sealed. So they're not as subject to the drying as if you had, open racks of wood laying out.
Okay. Huh, who knew?
Amazing. And they're plywood. We're not dealing with, we're not dealing with hardwoods or tone woods or anything like that in a speaker cabinet. It's plywood. So, hasn't been an issue.
And are you guys working on any, new amps now that you probably can't talk about, or are you pretty happy with the lineup?
Really happy with the lineup. We just launched the head version of the Bud. So that's the ultimate traveler. It's 3.5 pounds. It does everything for you. It's 120 watt amp, so it's a tiny head, it's an acoustic DI, it's a recording, it's it does everything. So those are just shipping now. We kind of launched them at NAMM. And then we've got some developments. We do have an amp that's a tube amp preamp. It's a hybrid. And that's been, we're working on another addition to that line. That's called the Forte, and it's a 12AX7 preamp based tube stage post our regular 5-band EQ. And man, it's a fun amp. It's not quite as plug and play intuitive because there's so many controls going on, but you can really dial in whatever you want with it. And it's ridiculously loud.
Yeah, and obviously the merits, you accept that tube amps or tube preamps at least have some merits that can't be achieved in solid state. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. Like I said, I think the ideal is for everybody to have 4 or 5 amps. They're all different. They're different tools for different jobs. Yeah. And there's, what spawned the development of the Forte was, like we were talking about earlier with the absence of polytone, we were kind of, there's that solid state sound, but then there's that Fender Twin, Fender Deluxe sound. And they're kind of apples and oranges when it comes to jazz in our background. So we wanted something for, people who want to play with that, that tube sound and feel. And we didn't have that. So without going into building all tube amplifiers, because that's a whole different business that I didn't want to get into, this hybrid made a lot of sense. It made really good use of our the Class AB power design that we had been using. And it just sounded so good when, again, Nate took he took one of his amps and just wired in the preamp in conjunction with the jazz amp. And it just worked. Sometimes with audio electronics, they're like recipes. Some things work, some things don't, regardless of what the theory is, but this just works.
Yeah. Nice. Do you have a whole library of classic amps to reference or to go back to, or maybe take apart?
I used to, It was the pile of amplifiers my dad went through when he was trying to find something he liked. And there were this great condition Gibson GA30 that I really liked, until it sort of hit this level of entropy where I got tired of paying to have it fixed. And I sold it to somebody who modded it beyond recognition, and he really likes it, but it was no longer collectible or even recognizable. We had a GA75, I think is the model number. It had a gigantic 15-inch speaker in it and 4 channels. And, that sounded great when it worked. Again, that was a 50s era Gibson, and when they're great, they're great.
Yeah.
We've got our bench engineer does a lot of repair work on the side for other people, and he's kind of a Princeton expert, and there's always at least 3 or 4 Princetons he's working on in the shop. There's a broken down JC120 in there somewhere. That's more of a junkyard thing than a reference amp. But so yeah, we're like everybody else. We have tons of other amplifiers laying around. Tons of guitars, tons of amps.
There's you mentioning that they constantly need work. There's a reason why that Truth About Vintage Amps podcast we do is one of our most successful endeavors, because everyone's having some issues at one point or another. Just to change gears. Go ahead.
Sure. I was just going to say, when we first started this out, there was a lot of the, what you couldn't really talk about amps without getting into the tube versus solid state discussion. And I just don't feel like it's a versus kind of discussion. I mean, it's like, you're talking about the vintage stuff and it being worked on. If you're going to relate it to cars, it'd be like talking about, a Tesla versus an old muscle car. It's just not the same. It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
they're both cars, but
yeah, I mean, the end result, as we often say on that podcast, is like, are you making good music or not? Like, yeah, it doesn't matter. You know,
are you feeling it? Are you liking what you're hearing? And when we develop, you asked about our development process, it basically stops when we can't put it down. You know, we're done when we can't stop playing it. That's when it's time to put it to market.
Just to switch gears for a second, Colorado, not necessarily known as being a jazz hub. There's Johnny Smith and there's Bill Frisell, those Colorado artists. You are quickly making it one with this Archtop Festival that you just created out of thin air. Talk to me about that.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm creating a jazz scene. I might be exposing one that's already here. Denver's kind of an island, you know. If last count, I think there's 2.8 million people in the metro drivable within an hour and a half area, but then there's nothing for like 9 hours. So it's not like much of the United States where you can cross state lines within an hour or two drive. So there's lots of people here. You just don't hear about them because it's a pretty big endeavor to leave or, you know, to come and go touring and whatnot. So we've got a lot of amazing players, but the reason that there's an Archtop Festival here is because there needed to be an Archtop Festival and nobody else was stupid enough to try to make it happen. So that leaves me. And it was great. We pulled it out of thin air. It came together in about 4 months. It was based on a 3 o'clock in the morning Facebook post. We do a lot of these guitar shows where there aren't a lot of amplifier companies, if any other amplifier companies. My friend Jerry Humphrey is Humphrey Amps. He's at a few of them. So because they're mostly acoustic guitar shows, and a lot of those builders don't install pickups unless they're by request. So they're pretty acoustic shows. So there's all, you know, the back of the room, there's me and, you know, a dozen or so people that just really build archtops, which almost always have a pickup installed in them. And it's such a special instrument with such a crazy history and, broad application that most people only associate it with jazz, but there's so much more an archtop is, that I felt like if we created a guitar show around that context, there were enough builders who also wanted to get that message out, and certainly enough players that we could build a show around it. And so we did.
Nice. And what, it's happening again this year, right?
It is September 11th, 12th, and 13th, same place. And it's happening in Arvada, Colorado, because that's where I live.
You got to make it sort of easy on yourself when you do these insurmountable things.
Well, what's great about this festival is it happens in, I call it my little town. It's 100 years ago, this was its own self-contained farm town, but it's sort of been absorbed by the metropolitan Denver area. And it's got lots of venues, lots of, you know, tap rooms and wine bar and coffee shop kind of stuff. And there's a train that runs here straight from the airport, and there's one hotel. So everything can kind of happen in this one little walkable space, immune from, you know, larger events going on in a larger metropolitan area, but not so far removed that you have to travel, way out in the boonies to attend it. It's just kind of it's a great spot for what it is.
Yeah.
And do you have a luthier showcase plus music festival, because all of the sponsored artists of these luthiers are invited. And so we had, I want to say we had over 35 hours of music last year, all free to the public, because it's a product demo going on in a coffee shop becomes a 1 hour performance.
Sure. Incredible. Who are some of the players coming this year, and who are some of the luthiers?
I don't have any confirmations I can really say publicly at this moment. because I haven't gotten back to my email responses, but it's most everybody from last year, as far as I know. Everybody said, yeah, I want to come back. I'm coming back. So I'll just say last year we had, and hope to have again, we had Ken Parker and Linda Manzer and Tom Rebecki and, you know, this amazing list of incredible luthiers, and some companies like Eastman and Roger Sadowski was there. Benedetto Guitars was there. I can't remember the whole list off the top of my head.
No, it's like your wedding, I'm sure. You can't remember any of the details, just that it happened.
Yeah, well, we had 23, I think 24. We had a last minute cancellation. So yeah, we had 23 luthiers. And again, this was just 4 months notice. Like, hey, you want to come to Colorado and do a quick, cheap guitar show? Let's do it. And it's just the town got behind me and said, yeah, that's great. What can we do? And so we have an arts and culture commission that helped me do some planning and some funding. And honestly, it was just the players who we've had developed these relationships with over the years emailed me and said, hey, I want to come. I want to be a part of it. And we apologized for it being the worst paying gig of all time that you had to travel to. everybody had a great time. So more details will be coming in the next few weeks as we finalize some stuff. But yeah, it's September 11th, 12th, and 13th. One thing for sure is that the week leading up to that, Frank Vignola's doing a camp that by now is probably sold out. It was a 30-ticket camp. And so they're doing that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then Frank's going to do a headlining performance for the Archtop Festival on Friday night. If you don't know Frank, he's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he did that just to kind of preface the festival he was already going to be at. That's really cool.
Well, he was talking to my friend Sean about doing the camp, and he was taking his camp on the road basically and wanted to do a Denver stop, I guess. And Sean said, hey, why don't you coincide it with this Archtop Festival? And so we got on the same page. And so it's going to be a pretty incredible week for Archtop guitars.
I bet. And I think I've said this probably to you before, but I have to imagine the cool thing about an Archtop Festival is, unlike some acoustic guitar flat top luthery festivals where everyone's kind of a fingerstyle player and just kind of tries to find a quiet corner by themselves, I imagine the jamming is off the charts at an Archtop Festival.
It's pretty ridiculous. There's a picture somewhere somebody has, I saw it on Facebook. There's a picture of Ted Ludwig and Jimmy Bruno playing a duet in this coffee shop that I go to every morning. And there's some girl like doing her homework sitting right next to Jimmy Bruno. No idea who he is. Cause it's just an average everyday, you know, Saturday for people who didn't know the festival was going on. But, we assigned everybody a demo spot. And a lot of them said, you know, hey, can I play with so-and-so? And we're like, yeah, you know, you're the professional, you do whatever you want. And so a lot of impromptu guitar trios broke out. There were people in the lobby of the hotel up all hours, just handing guitars back and forth. Here, check this out, try this. A lot of people from opposite coasts who'd never met in person got to play together for the first time. And a lot of people from different styles, some very straight ahead players and some very modern players. Some fingerstyle acoustic players who just happened to like playing on an arch top, versus a flat top. That's kind of what we want to focus this on, is the versatility of the instrument. It's, you know, a lot like our amplifiers. They're very highly associated with jazz because that's where we come from, but that's not by any means the limit of their usefulness.
Sure. Yeah. Well, very cool. I know I'm looking forward to coming.
Oh, great, man. That's going to be so fun.
Yeah.
It's above all else, the quest for the great hang, right?
Of course. That's really what we're all looking for. Yeah.
Exactly.
Hopefully virus free.
Yeah, that's, I don't think we'll suffer the same fate as South by Southwest, as I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Not quite that large
totally.
Of an event. But, I like the shows because you get to, see and touch and play this guitar, but talk directly to the person who built it. And, why is this bridge like this? Why is this, why is this this way? Why is this nut this size? That kind of stuff, and really get into the guitar itself and, play it and sort of feel what they're talking about. And, it's great.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's why the fretboard journal exists, so we can meet these characters that sometimes we can't meet in person, but if you can meet them in person, all the better.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, well, Peter, thank you so much for talking to me. This was great, and it was great to hear a little bit of the story behind these amps that I keep lusting after, so.
Well, you know where to find me.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And
no, it was great. It was great talking to you too, Jason. I really appreciate the time.
It's, of course.
I love talking about gear.
We love to as well, and I'll see you in Colorado.
All right, man.
Thank you.